Stand by, we're about to begin. Good day and welcome to the TANF Redesign Human Services Modernization Webinar. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Frank Shields. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Welcome to the State TANF Redesign Human Services Modernization Efforts Webinar. This webinar is brought to you by the Administration for Children and Families, Region 10 office located in Seattle, Washington. I have a short prepared statement I'd like to read just to provide some background, explain the purpose of the call. For nearly 20 years, federal and state governments have been working together to simplify, streamline, and enhance publicly financed human services programs. Their work has been driven by dynamic caseloads, a desire to maximize public resources available to serve at-risk individuals and families, and the need to create more effective and efficient government services. In many ways, these efforts have been successful. Most states have embraced increasing access and simplifying policies, particularly in federally funded programs like Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. States have streamlined processes, made procedures more client-friendly, reduced paperwork, and sought to increase outreach to potentially eligible individuals. As a result, millions of at-risk individuals who might not have obtained vital human services supports now do. This morning you'll hear from staff from Washington State, Hawaii, and the District of Columbia who will discuss their state TANF read, including the process, lessons learned, and progress made thus far. At the end of the presentations, you'll have an opportunity to ask questions through the Adobe platform, and you can also submit questions throughout the webinar using the Q&A pod on the right side of your computer screen. If your question is for a specific speaker or program, please specify this in your question. Following the presentations, we will ask you to respond to a brief evaluation poll. Your feedback is important and helps shape our delivery of technical assistance. Also, all the materials from today's webinar will be posted on the Peer TA Network website. It will be sent directly to those of you registered for the webinar within a few weeks. Our moderator today is Leslie Smith, the project manager with ICF International, and our first speaker today is Babette Roberts, Director of Community Services Division of the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services.
I don't see my presentation up though, so. Anyway. So I'll just go ahead and start while you guys figure that one out. Good morning, and I'm going to say good morning even though for most of you it's late in the afternoon. It's still morning here in Washington. I'm going to speak briefly today about the basics of Washington's Work First redesign efforts, and Work First in Washington is the welfare to work portion of the TANF program. Then I'll talk a little bit about what we've done to implement the recommendations that came out of that design phase, and talk more in depth about the next steps of our improvement journey. And then I'm just kind of embed the lessons learned along the way, because there have been many lessons learned. Could you go to the next slide, please? So by way of background, the redesign efforts began in Washington State in 2010 as a result primarily of the recession. And we were facing, as many states, all states were facing, shrinking state revenues, no increases in the federal TANF funding program since its authorization in 96, and rising caseloads. The redesign efforts that we pulled together were a broad-based roundtable effort that included legislators, stakeholders, staff, clients, partner agencies, and partners in delivery of services to this population. The governor, then Governor Greg Warr, directed our Work First subcabinet in Washington. We have a subcabinet level partnership, that, and she asked us to provide a plan that would implement evidence-based practices that would be sustainable and would help us to reboot the program moving into the 21st century and set the stage for us to really bounce out of the recession and help the population. But that redesign had five primary core assumptions that we were guided by during the redesign phase of that process. And those were, first and foremost, that this is all about, the workforce program is still all about achieving stable and successful employment for clients. And it remains the primary objective of our program. We want to move workforce clients, those clients that are subject to federal work participation requirements, to stable employment and then on to employment that leads that client along a pathway designed to move them off of all public assistance and into a life of self-sufficiency. That's still our primary goal with this program. That will always be our primary goal with this program. But further, we wanted to ensure that as we do all of that work, we wanted to do that in a family-centered engagement approach, that because we believe it's really necessary to understand the entire dynamic of that family, to assist that family in removing barriers that prevent the adults in that family from moving on to that stable employment and that self-sufficiency track. And then ultimately, if we can do that, we can potentially break the cycle of poverty for that family. We wanted to also know that we have policies that recognize the critical, both the critical role and the critical responsibility that parents have in that child's life. So again, focusing on breaking that cycle and not just on focusing moving that parent to a job. We also felt that one of the guiding core assumptions needed to be that to ourselves as well as to our clients, that TANF is transitional. This is not a long-term program, and we must be diligent ourselves as case managers and programs, as well as diligent in holding our clients accountable to moving along that pathway. And that it's important, finally, to realize that TANF is not the sole resource that we can use to achieve those goals, and that it's important for us to leverage every option and opportunity that's available to us and to our clients. Next slide. I always like to throw this particular slide in any presentation I'm doing around workforce because it shows just the sheer volume of work that has been done around policy changes and process changes in our workforce program in the last 3 years. It's a huge amount of work that has been done, and all of our redesign efforts were done within existing resources. No additional resources were provided to the state to move this program along and to implement this redesign. It's been an incredible lift. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. That could take me all day. Next slide. There were 8 broad recommendations that came out of the 2010 redesign report that went to our governor, was approved by our governor, and work began to implement those changes within, as I said, within available resources. We also worked to implement other legislative changes and budgetary changes that came to the program that were not part of the redesign, thus, hence the slide before. And to date, we've made progress on many of those areas. The largest items we have undertaken, the slide that you're looking at, the bolded areas show items where there has been work done and or completed. The largest item that we've undertaken is the performance measure and assessment work that we've done, and we'll talk more, I'll talk more in detail in further slides about those two areas just a bit later. But to highlight some of those other areas where there is no bold, where it's not bolded, we haven't forgotten those areas, but other things have had to happen first before we could move into them. So a brief description of those things that are underway and or complete. So the first one, the implementing additional reasonable requirements and supports for child-only families. This is predominantly focused at our kinship care or relative caregiver child-only families. And what we've done here, starting in 2011, we've held meetings around the state with local kinship navigators, area agencies on aging, because predominantly we're talking about grandparents raising kids, raising grandchildren, and representatives from our offices as well as our child welfare offices to work with them around how do we provide additional supports for those kinship families, and at the same time that we implemented a means testing around that population as well. So not just means testing the child, but the family that the child is living with. The second one involving the participants and local partners, this is something that we'll have further conversation about later, but have not been able to get to this at this point yet. The strengthening our assessment process is a big issue, and I'm going to discuss that in the next slide, so I'm going to skip that one as well, and talk about implementing new requirements for workforce families with young children. This is one that was fairly easy for us, and we completed that in March of 2011, essentially aligning our state policy with the federal policy. In Washington, we had a policy that was somewhat more restrictive than the federal policy, in that we required all parents to participate at full-time level, whereas the federal rule is parents could choose to participate at only 20 hours a week in a core accountable activity. So we have relaxed that that rule at this point. Our community jobs program is going on to improving employment pathways. We have a very robust, nationally recognized community jobs program, which is our subsidized jobs program. In partnership with our Department of Commerce, who implements that program. And while that is an excellent, excellent program, we see wonderful outcomes for families in that program, we and they did not want to stop there. And so we've implemented two additional supported work programs. One is Job Connection, and the other is a Career Development Employment Program. The two programs are designed to meet different types of employment needs for than what is met in a community job setting. So a community job continues to provide a service to help TANF families manage barrier issues while they're in a supported employment program and build some skills. The Job Connection program is designed to help those participants who need to focus on skill development while they get a job readiness and coaching skill. So it kind of combines those areas. It's a little bit more in-depth for them. The Career Development Program, one we're very, very excited about, actually provides TANF recipients who are enrolled in a school program or vocational education program with an employment experience that supports the education pathway that they're on. So it provides them, it connects with their vocational education and says, let's get you a community job or a subsidized job that is in that field of work. So they graduate from their voc program with some work, actual work experience in that field. And then these programs are designed to meet individual needs of a wider TANF population. We also work with our Employment Security Department in employment programs and in moving people down a pathway. And after a long period of piloting, they have launched a new employment service model called Career Scope. And that is built on an engaging and motivating customers method, which focuses on more fully engaging the job seeker in their work readiness process and ultimate employment success. And it shifts away from that one-size-fits-all transactional type of model for more towards an individualized, even a transformational type of approach that focuses on meeting that particular person or that particular job seeker where they are in their readiness cycle and designs their job search around that. In moving on, number six, implementing individualized case management, this is something we're also very excited about. And our case managers in the Department of Social and Health Services are all going through a very robust training program in motivational interviewing. So not just the basics of motivational interviewing, but actually getting to that kind of expertise level. So going through the initial phases, what is it, how do you do it, and then moving through the process to get to full fidelity in this kind of a motivational interviewing and engagement strategy. The training provides staff with tools to build a better rapport, to more effectively engage those families, and hopefully be able to really get to the heart of what's going on and have that trust build into better engagement and then getting to those barriers that are preventing that self-sufficiency quicker. As part of implementing this particular statewide strategy, we've had to put some dollars into this. So we've shifted some things around and put some dollars into doing this training. But we're building a trainer type of module, so we'll have some expertise to continue to train for this, so we won't continually have to purchase it. We'll be able to more fully develop this as part of our initial training process for our case managers and really embed this as a bedrock on how we do case management. In terms of reintroducing post-TANF services, and I think that everyone in Washington agrees that as people move off of TANF, they're not yet in a self-sufficiency mode, and one of the key factors in preventing them from coming back on is being able to give them some post-TANF supports and some way of connecting with someone who can help them. And this is something we're in the process of trying to implement, but have some IT constraints. I don't want to mention the Affordable Care Act here, but we'll just go on. We have some IT constraints around how to get that done, and we're looking at about 18 months from implementation. And then finally, nothing around a workforce redesign process would be useful if we weren't evaluating what we were doing and how it was working. And so we have revised our what we call our chart book, which has, 50 or 60 pages of data, into something a little bit more robust that that will help us to really understand where we're going and what those are, and I'm going to talk about that just a little bit further. We're also preparing to just launch in a couple of weeks 6 lean process improvement projects around the workforce program. Again, I'm going to talk about those in a few minutes. So next slide. So let's talk about the comprehensive evaluation, the assessment tool, because this is something I'm really excited about in Washington. One of the key improvements that we have is this process, and what we're doing is revising our comprehensive evaluation, and the goal is to produce a single workforce assessment tool or process that has characteristics like producing a comprehensive and cumulative plan that tracks progress and outcomes. So not just for 3 months or 6 months, but what is it we're trying to go? How far? Where is the end goal? And we can talk about that with families. That has initial online self-screening by the applicant, something they can do on their own, a TurboTax-like model that allows them to go in as they're applying and tell us a little bit about what's going on with them and self-assess themselves. It expands from this more basic kind of thing to a more targeted question, and it aligns with profiles from our research and data analysis unit that was the basis of some of our recommendations about what we know about our client population now, and it lets us, will let us eventually begin to build those engagement tracks that we would like to build that more individualize how we deal with families. And certainly it will incorporate a whole family and a strength-based approach to how we work with these families. The new evaluation will be organized into 3 sections. So a case manager and a client can complete all 3 at one sitting or may stop after any one section depending on what they find and what they think the family needs to focus on. So this first section of the comprehensive evaluation would be intended to identify that emergent or urgent need that exists with the family. What brought them to us? What requires immediate stabilization before we can move them on to anything else? And this is designed to get to things like housing and housing stability, homelessness, domestic violence, mental health or substance abuse issues. Are they pregnant? Do they have a physical disability? What's going on that's the most immediate and urgent issue that's the barrier to moving them to a job? The second section is where we intend to begin addressing the more general information and family structure considerations. The non-emergent questions kind of related to that first topic, but gets to the strengths and support systems that might be available to that family. What are their childcare needs? What's going on with their children's education? Do they have a child involved in the juvenile justice system? What's going on around the child's welfare, the family's welfare, and their whole family health needs? To make sure that we're not trying to push a family that's also involved in a juvenile justice issue or a child welfare issue in a direction that's going to be detrimental to dealing with that issue. And then finally, getting to the section that's intended to delve into that employability and education, including things like what's their vocational history, what's their work history, do they have any current work, what are their reasons for not working, is there some learning disabilities or some other challenges? Do they have educational goals? What transportation or legal issues do they have? This is that portion that's going to try and help us figure out where they go next. So that's the initial kind of self-assessment. As you can see from this slide, though, towards the green boxes, we're also looking at developing sort of a follow-up evaluation. or an evaluation that we can use with the family prior to and after entry for sanction, should that actually the family actually go in that direction. That will help us to get in depth of what's going on with that sanction. We've completed user testing for this prototype in September, and information's being analyzed about that. The proposed tool works in real practice. A series of clients and staff surveys, focus groups were completed in those user testing sites. The initial feedback indicated a real concern about the length of the process, and so we're looking at that, and that the order and context of some of the questions need to be kind of ironed out, and we're working on those as well. We're making final changes to the tool, and we'll be rolling that out by July of next year. So next slide. The second part of our assessment improvement involves the construction and implementation of what we're calling TANF PRISM. This is a predictive modeling tool that will leverage data from multiple sources that we have in our client database for the department and help us to identify an employability score for a client, but also help us to flag barriers that maybe the family hasn't given to us yet. So this tool will give the case manager some valuable supplemental information that, paired with the new comprehensive evaluation, allows them to better tailor both their questions and their case management engagement activities with that client. And it will allow us to identify barriers that maybe the family isn't quite ready to address and hasn't really seen. So for instance, being able to see whether they've had a history with Department of Corrections or local jails may be something they haven't told us, but that we would need to know in determining what pathway we might want to set them on or help them get towards. Those kinds of things. So, next slide. So the next thing, the large undertaking that we've been building upon, and this has taken quite a number of resources across many of the departments that are working with us, is to really look at what is the existing performance data, the evaluation type of data that we have around this program. And we were asked to look at measurements in three kind of groupings. TANF children and youth are doing well, TANF adults and families are doing well, and TANF parents are doing well economically. So those kinds of three broad areas. And so convened another group. We gathered some baseline data around each of these measures. We collaborated with our own internal research and data analysis folks, our own management accountability folks, as well as the Office of Financial Management and forecasting data to really get a baseline on what's going on across systems and begin to talk about that. Can you go to the next slide? So this slide really kind of gets down to how are we doing this. In order to have measurements of program progress, we developed, can you go to the next slide? We are developing a new system of measurement. They're intended to provide indicators of the health of the program. So there are three types of measurements we're now capturing to get to those three questions we talked about. We have some targeted outcomes, and these are measurements that have specific target expectations. So like the work participation rate, exits for increased income, exits to employment, those kinds of things have targeted specific outcomes that tell us how is the program working specifically getting to those outcomes we know we need to have. And then we have drivers, and these are measurements of activities or actions that need to be taken in order to ensure we reach those outcomes and that clients are successful. So, for instance, if we identify a mental health need, but it never gets addressed in that individual responsibility plan, we're not likely to have a successful outcome with that family. And so we need to know, are we hitting those drivers? So we have metrics that say identified a drug and alcohol need, and it was addressed in the plan. Those kinds of driver measurements are very important for us to look at as well. And then we have what we're calling barometers. These are measurements that point out what is happening in a variety of areas, and each is given really a range of acceptable or expected performance outcomes. And when that measure moves out of that range, either negatively or positively, it'll trigger us to look at, to do a further analysis and identify what's the root cause of that, and should changes be made? Or if it's a good thing, if it's going out of range in a good way, are there things that we can learn and apply those best practices across the program? And those are things like, have we identified the homelessness at risk? The stability of childcare is an interesting one. Are we looking at our children moving around to different providers, and what can that tell us about what's going on with the family? Dependency, mental health treatment, and whether they the client moves towards that or actually engages in that. Those are things that are barometers for us. But we're also looking at TANF youth enrolled in school, and are they progressing in school according to their grade levels? How many are actually graduating is an interesting one that we'd want. And are we seeing increases or decreases in financial literacy, high school education, GED, those kinds of things. So, I think I'm going to be running out of time soon, so I got to go quickly. Given the reality that I'm going to move on to the next slide, this is moving on to what our Workforce Improvement Plan is now. The reality we face today is that we have rising federal participation targets. There have been some clarifications in the calculations that we need to get to, and we get some rising participation targets that we're going to struggle to meet. And we are trying very hard to, in Washington, to strike that balance between maintaining our commitment to engagement that matters. This is a catchphrase we're using in Washington, engagement that matters, but still meeting that participation. So it's that balance between engagement that matters and participation that counts. So it's an interesting balance we're trying to strike. Our Workforce Improvement Plan has 13 elements that you can see, and those that are in orange on the slide are related to elements that we've talked about in the workforce redesign process, and things like working family supports. This is a post-TANF program that we're looking to implement, and given our IT systems, may take us a couple of months to or a year to implement. We're also, though, proposing to look at a 15% incentive for meeting the workforce participation rate, so giving an additional caseload or grant amount to clients who are actually meeting the rate. We're looking at increasing access to life skills training and those kinds of targeted and modular trainings geared to meet people dealing with conflicts or overcoming their criminal history, et cetera. We're increasing the use of unpaid work experience programs, and we'll be expanding how we use those and really talking about using these not so much as just an activity that counts, but as a filler between activities and as a ramp to appropriate transitional steps that will help families who need, aren't quite ready for a subsidized employment, but really could use this as experience to get to ready for a subsidized employment. We're looking at implementing a new workforce orientation and beginning to look at design around that. We are looking at increasing the participation requirements for two-parent households. We have done this in the past. We're required both parents to participate, and we may look at going back to that. One of the things that we're looking at, too, is focusing our case management. And I think a lot of states will be understand this, but in our program, we also provide eligibility determinations for other services. It's not just TANF that we do. We do SNAP and Medicaid and child care subsidies as well. And during the recession, as Washington implemented a hiring freeze across the state, a three-year-long hiring freeze, it was necessary for us to use some of our case managers in that frontline eligibility determination, and we shuffled our focus away from case management in a lot of places. Post-recession, as the revenues are coming up and we've been able to hire, we're refocusing our case managers, retraining, and getting that motivational interviewing, and really starting to put some emphasis back on that and the ability to do that. So that's been very helpful in moving in this direction. We are also going to be doing some practice assistance visits, what we're calling technical assistance visits, to starting with our 15 largest offices, which serve more than 60% of our participants, and going out and seeing what they're doing well for those places where they're actually exceeding the participation targets and engaging clients, moving them off of TANF and into employment, and see what practices we can develop and take to those other offices that may not be doing as well. These two other items that I'm going to talk about really quickly are recommendations the department has made and not yet authorized, and we're not at a point where I can even say we're going to do them. But Washington is looking at reducing the sanction period and reducing the infant exemption period. So currently we have a 4-month sanction. We're looking at bringing that down to a 1-month sanction. So essentially it's you're identified as sanctioned, and in the next month you have 1 month to cure. We're also looking at bringing our reducing our infant exemption period from a currently we have a 12-month exemption to 3-month exemption. So those are kind of the programs that we're doing. And then I think next slide is the other workforce improvement plan we have is the lean projects that I wanted to just quickly touch on. This is actually out of our redesign efforts in the original redesign plan, but also in our improvement plan, is really looking at 6 areas where we think we can focus and say, what's going on? Is there a way that we can streamline this process and really bring line staff in from not only our department, but in our partner agencies, our local planning agencies, and some of our provider communities to come in and look at what can we do to streamline some efforts? And these are the areas that we're looking at potentially doing that. One place we see a lot of churn where the client kind of gets referred and then referred back and then referred back is in that job search area. So we want to look at that, and that's going to be our first one. We're going to look at how we prepare the federal report and make sure that we're getting all the right data. Have we given all the right instructions to our staff on how to report and what counts and what doesn't? And so we're going to look at that process as well. We're going to look at the verification and documentation once we know about the federal report. And then we're going to work with our partners at the State Board for Community and Technical Colleges about how to increase the successful outcomes for educational activities. One of the things that we've seen in this program is that there are a large number or a large percentage of our clients do not complete these educational programs, and we want to look at what's going on there and what we can do to improve that. And then also look at reducing the gap in transitioning from one component to another and kind of minimize the loss of countable activity in that transition gap. And then finally, the improving engagement and moving past barrier removal to an actual work activity. I would say in terms of lessons learned, just very quickly across this whole spectrum, we've had to do this with very few resources, and that's created some slowdowns with this. If there's an ability to bring additional resources in, I would say that's great. The other lesson learned, I would say, things that we did well around this project is getting project management around it. We did assign in this whole redesign effort a project manager and somebody who is responsible for making sure we're hitting deadlines and moving things forward, and that was really important to just getting as much done as we did. So next slide would be thanks. That's kind of what I have to say, and I'm assuming during the question and answer we'll have questions. I hope I didn't go over my time.
Thank you, Babette. This is Leslie Smith, moderator for today's webinar. Thank you much for your presentation. Next, I'd like to welcome Lori Young and Catherine Scardino of the Hawaii Department of Human Resources. Lori?
Hi. Aloha, everyone. Can I just remind everyone that we are not online, so we are not looking at any slides. We're just on the telephone. So if you can just help us along regarding the slides. I'll try to remember to tell you to move the slides, but I'm not watching the slide online. To begin, we're going to talk about asset reform, and it's probably the perfect topic because Frank mentioned in his introduction that ACF wants us to streamline and simplify our programs, and that's really the byproduct of this asset reform. But if you look at the first slide, we actually did this legislation in 2013 and got it passed this year. But we have to really backtrack or go back to 2008 when the legislature asked us to convene a task force. And it was a resolution, and they wanted us to look at financial education and asset building. And The idea was for our TANF families, the idea was for to promote self-sufficiency, you really need to have ability to build assets. And with our current policy in Hawaii, we had an asset limit of $5,000, and it was felt that that was not sufficient to have to be self-sufficient. To have we basically needed more more assets to become self-sufficient. So the task force was convened in 2008, and it was a mixture of community organizations, poverty groups, even financial institutions. And they met for roughly about a year and a half. And the result of it, next slide, is their long-term, they had a number of recommendations, but their long-term recommendation was that eventually it was the hope that all of our financial programs, there would be no asset limit. And actually, we ended up modifying that a bit, but that was their long-term recommendation, that none of our financial programs would need to deal with an asset limit. And so that was the long-term recommendation of the task force. And we submitted that report to the 2010 legislature, and at that time, it wasn't quite the right time to try to go ahead and submit a bill to actually suggest that we wanted to eliminate the asset limit. We were still in the midst of the recession, so it wasn't a good time. And then in 2011, we had a new governor, and it was still probably not quite the right time to submit a bill. And then meanwhile, in 2012, next slide, we had you should be looking at the slide that says House Resolution 124, by the way, 2012 Hawaii State Legislature. There was by that time, another resolution by the legislature to again do another. This time it wasn't a task force, but it was a study. So through the years, the legislature just about every single year will bring up some kind of bill regarding, you know, looking at the TANF asset limit. We've had bills that say, oh, increase it to 10,000, increase it to 15,000. You know, every year there was something. So in 2012, another resolution, and this time it wasn't necessarily, in fact, I think if I recall correctly, I think we did have several bills trying to increase the asset limit from the 5,000 to 10,000 or 15. But the resolution at that time said to convene or to do a study to see the to look at the feasibility of it. So that's what we did. So in 2012, we did a study. Next slide. And the study actually began at the end of 2012, and it took about a year for the study. And we looked at the states that did eliminate the asset limit. And there were just six states, and now we're the seventh state, as far as I know. And Ohio, Virginia, Louisiana, Alabama, and Maryland. At the time we began the study, Colorado had an asset limit of 15,000, and then in 2011, they just eliminated it entirely. And I spoke to someone in Colorado at the time, and they basically said they decided to do this sort of incremental type of legislation. They felt that when they increased it to 15,000, they didn't think the community or legislators were going to, they would have opposed trying to eliminate it. They suggested the elimination, that is. So they were afraid that just going forward and saying let's eliminate the asset limit wasn't going to be well received. So they decided to go with the 15,000, and eventually in 2011 they just completely eliminated it. So they did it in sort of two phases. Hawaii decided perhaps we didn't want to just do that. We just said just go ahead and propose just eliminating the asset limit. So that's what we decided to do. And by the way, The six states, we did and talked to all of them, and they said basically since the time they eliminated that limit, there was really no impact in their caseload. That was what the fear was, that the caseload would rise because we wouldn't consider assets in determining eligibility. So next slide, where it says why eliminate. Of course, Virginia said they said that the time limits made them obsolete because after all, we had 5 years. Louisiana said conflicting program goals, promoting and encouraging the goals of self-sufficiency, yet the application of the TANF asset test penalized families for owning assets, and that was where Hawaii was coming from. And Alabama, of course, confirmed with, like everyone else, that had eliminated the asset limit, that they showed very few the impact on caseload. And also that their existing caseload had very few assets in the first place. Next slide. So what happened with our further findings, we concluded that effective at the end of this year or beginning in January 2014, Medicaid was going to eliminate the asset limit for non-disabled individuals. So we're trying to streamline and simplify and make it consistent with other programs. And of course, many SNAP households are categorically eligible under broad-based categorical eligibility. So they've eliminated the asset limit as well. And then we concluded that income eligibility, of course, is going to be still an eligibility factor. And people with low income generally have few assets. So we still have the income eligibility limit. And so if you have low income, you probably have very little assets. And then in terms of simplifying the program, next slide under DHS study findings. The asset test, we discovered, really imposes a burden on both the staff as well as, of course, the families, because they are required to provide verification of the value, and it delays processing of the eligibility, maybe even deny benefits to families who fail to provide the proof of whatever the value of the asset is, even though the asset may be well below our $5,000 standard. Just the fact that they failed to provide a bank statement could cause them to be ineligible when they had, $10 in their bank statement, so, or in their account. So it just eliminates that burden for both the families and, of course, administratively. And finally, we recognize that financial savings and asset accumulation are essential for families to work towards self-sufficiency. Next slide. So when our study, we decided, of course, to actually look at our numbers. And we looked back 3 years. And on average, if there was somebody that was denied due to assets in Hawaii, it was not many people. And you can look at the slide that the average, by the time we came to 2012, the average number of families denied were 4 a month. And when we actually looked at the numbers, a lot of them was due to property, the value of property that they probably inherited or something like that. So it even shrank the numbers even further. So we really saw that these families had very few assets. So finally, next slide, our recommendation was in all the six states, it was always an elimination of the asset limit, even with Medicare come 2014, and even with the broad-based categorical eligibility, it's always eliminate the asset limit. But we decided to modify that and just simply disregard the assets under the TANF program. So we ended up not going for expanding this legislation to all the programs. So it's just strictly TANF. we have a GA program here, and of course an aged blind and disabled program here, and we decided to leave the asset limits alone under those programs. But under the TANF program, we have the legislation is to disregard assets entirely rather than eliminate the asset limit. And it, as you can see from the explanation on the slide, it didn't. If we simply eliminated the asset limit, it did not relieve or eliminate the administrative burden of still calculating the value of assets. It still was required just by the way the rules suggest. So we decided to just go ahead and eliminate the burden entirely and disregard TANF assets. And the bill was passed. Next slide. There was a House bill introduced in the 2013 legislative session, and that is the statute, the way it reads there on the slide. And the governor signed that into law on April 18, 2013. With no opposition, actually. So we were very surprised there was no opposition. But it was a very successful legislative session for us. That's about it on our asset reform. So I'm going to pass this on to Catherine, and she'll be discussing the C3T program.
Hi, Leslie, maybe we could start off with slide one. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Catherine Sardino. I'm the Employment and Training Program Administrator for the Hawaii Department of Human Services, Benefit Employment and Support Services Division. I will be doing the presentation on the C3T program and also the C Hawaii Work Program. Slide two, please. The University of Hawaii Community Colleges, or UHCC, received a $24.6 million grant from the U.S. Department of Labor and developed a statewide post-secondary education and vocational training program called Community College Career and Training Program, or for short, C3T. The C3T program currently offers employer-driven courses that lead to career pathways in three industries to start. Agriculture, energy, and health. The courses incorporate basic skills and contextualized methods and are developed like building blocks to ensure students are successful and are able to obtain jobs after completion. Slide three, please. The C3T program targets working age individuals who are unemployed, underemployed, dislocated workers, and disadvantaged individuals, such as our TANF recipients. Slide four, please. These are the seven University of Hawaii Community College campuses statewide that offer C3T courses. Slide five, please. And just a brief information on the three focus industries of the C3T program. Our state currently imports between 80 to 90% of our food supply, so the agriculture courses are developed to help increase our state's food production. And here are a few of the C3T agriculture courses: aquaponics, sustainable agriculture, food safety, plant bioscience, and agriculture and natural resources. Slide six, please. In addition to importing food, Hawaii also imports a great amount of oil for fuel and energy sources. So the energy courses will support small businesses and the growth of local green jobs. Here are a few of the energy courses being offered through the C3T program, such as automotive technology for hybrid and electric vehicles, photovoltaic systems, sustainable construction technology, and home energy survey profession. Slide seven, please. Lastly, healthcare. Hawaii has a shortage of specialty healthcare professionals, which is more prominent on the neighbor island. And here is a short list of healthcare courses being offered: surgical technology, pharmacy technician, medical laboratory technician, occupational and physical therapy assistant, and adult residential care operator. Slide 8, please. According to our State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, these are the estimated wages that families need to earn in order to be self-sufficient in Hawaii. The standard includes housing, food, transportation, childcare, health care, taxes, and miscellaneous expenses such as telephone, internet, clothing, personal care expenses, and household supplies. So as you can see here, the average employment income, which is $8.50, is far less than earning levels needed for families to independently meet their basic needs. Slide 9, please. So we need to lessen the disparity between earnings of TANF families and the self-sufficiency standard. And to do so, we are incorporating the C3T program as another major component to our TANF work program. We see the C3T program as a viable option for TANF recipients to pursue education so they may obtain employment that offer earnings above the minimum wage and can develop into career opportunities with wage progression. We plan to integrate the C3T program with our TANF work program subsidized employment in order to develop career pathways for TANF recipients. Our subsidized employment program is called See Hawaii Work, which I will be presenting shortly. If after a reasonable amount of job search activities do not result in unsubsidized employment, then participants would be referred to the See Hawaii Work program for assistance with employment placements in their specialized fields. We hope to see positive results for our TANF families by integrating both the education and subsidized employment programs. Slide 10, here is our contact information. This concludes my presentation on the integration of C3T program into our state TANF work program, and I'll transition into our next presentation on the See Hawaii work program. So if we can bring the PowerPoint up for that. Thanks. Can someone let me know if it's already up?
Yes, we're good to go.
Okay, thank you. So See Hawaii Work is the subsidized employment component under Hawaii's TANF Work Program. TANF families have may have the barriers that impact their ability to obtain or retain employment. For example, some may lack education, skills, work history, or other evidence of their employability. So Hawaii's TANF population is very diverse, so there are TANF recipients that have limited English proficiency. About 28% of our state's population speaks a language other than English. Also, with a very diverse population, we do encounter conflicts between cultures and values. Other factors such as negative work history, criminal background, substance abuse, and lack of personal self-esteem and motivation are also potential barriers for individuals' ability to obtain or retain employment. Slide 3, please. So in 2005, Hawaii developed the See Hawaii Work Program, often referred to as the C program. It was developed using a training for hire and apprenticeship model to provide on-the-job training and additional work opportunities for TANF recipients. The program is structured to also help businesses meet their labor demands, thereby making a positive impact to our state's economy. Slide 4, please. So currently, the subsidies that we provide include wage reimbursement at Hawaii's minimum wage level, which is $7.25 an hour. We add another 50 cents for each dollar per hour that employers pay in excess of the minimum wage, up to $12 an hour. We also add 14% of the total subsidized wage to assist assist employers with administrative costs, such as training, unemployment, insurance, workers' compensation, and FICA. Lastly, we also pay up to $200 per month to employers that assist participants with transportation. When a participant is hired, the employers agree to provide a minimum of 24 hours per week for a period of up to 3 months. Employments may be extended for up to 3 months for a total of 6 months. Previously, our C agreements were set for a 12-month period or 2 6-month periods, but employers felt that a 6-month period was sufficient to assess and train our participants. Slide 5, please. Employers benefited financially when they hired employees through the C program because it increased their ability to hire additional staff. They also found the recruitment process to be easy because participants were already pre-screened and came prepared with resumes and interviewing skills. Lastly, many of our participating C employers are small local businesses, so they felt it was a contribution to their communities to assist needy families. And if recipients employed through the C program receive on-the-job training, guidance and mentoring from employers, and individualized job coaching. Slide 6, please. So during the state fiscal year ending June 30, 2013, there were a total of 378 employers participating with the C program. Of these employers, 165 hired participants. A total of 425 participants obtained employment through the C program. And of those participants, 200 transitioned to unsubsidized employment. C participants worked an average of 30 hours per week, which is well above the C program's requirement of 24 hours per week. And participants' wages ranged between the minimum wage at $7.25 per hour and as high as $15.38 per hour. Slide 7, please. Since 2005, a little over 1,300 employers placed job orders with the C program. C Hawaii Work also participated as a case study with the Promising Pathways Initiative, sponsored by HHS, ACF, OFA. The C program has become a significant component of Hawaii's TANF work program, and most recently we've made modifications to our case management system to allow case managers to submit electronic referrals to C, capture data in-house, and issue direct deposit payments into employers' bank accounts, eliminating the need for a third-party vendor to issue employer payments. As I mentioned in my C3T presentation, we'll be integrating the C program for participants that successfully complete their courses but are unable to find unsubsidized employment. The goal will be for the C program to assist participants with employment placements in their specialized fields. Before I conclude this presentation, I wanted to share a couple of lessons learned when we implemented the C program, and which we anticipate will be the same for the integration of the C3T program. It took about 2 to 3 years for the C program to pick up steam for employers to participate and also case managers to utilize the C program as an additional resource or support for unemployed and underemployed TANF recipients. So like the C program, we are now encountering the same issues with C3T. We're working to connect the community colleges to the work program units directly to educate our staff on the C3T program and the courses offered and other support services that the C3T program may provide, such as student and academic coaching. We will also utilize our work group sessions with case managers as a platform to discuss the needs of our TANF recipients and encourage them to also utilize C3T program as another resource. So this concludes our presentation on the C Hawaii Work Program.
Thank you, Lori and Catherine. Next, I'd like to welcome Deborah Carroll and Brian Campbell with the District of Columbia Department of Human Services. Deborah?
She's probably talking on mute.
Brian, are you there? Could you begin?
I am. Hopefully she's going to hop back on. Why don't you flip to the next slide?
Thank you.
Okay. Can you go to the next slide? So, actually, I'm going to hold on. She's gone through this whole thing, and I haven't, so I'm just more supporting the questions. But what I think she wants to talk about is what we've done in terms of implementing a tiered model of delivery system for our TANF customers. Historically, the District of Columbia had essentially one-size-fits-all model. When our customers came in to receive services, we'd essentially send them out to one set of service providers, and that service provider would essentially be in charge of everything in terms of from folks who needed significant substance abuse services to those who are ready for essentially jobs right out of the gate. So what we found that did, it simply didn't work because those who had the higher needs didn't have their needs met, as well as those who had the lower needs didn't have their needs met. So what we did, we decided we were going to have a tiered delivery model, essentially breaking down into what we call suites of services based upon what the specific needs of the individual is. And go ahead and go to the next slide, please. Again, going back to much of what actually Washington had looked at as well in terms of why we decided we needed to do this.
Hi, guys, I'm back.
Okay, Deborah. Hop on, Deborah.
All right, sorry about that. So we started around the same time as Washington State, somewhere around 2010, with our redesign efforts. We had a growing caseload. Our caseload during the recession increased by over 3,000 families. Our effective rate, we have funding. We fund our TANF program through three funding streams, the TANF, the MOE, and then we have a local fund that we also use. The effective rate across all three funding streams was extremely low, anywhere between 5 and 10%. And so we wanted to see some improvement in that. And you know, at any given time, we were only able to serve about 3,900 families, and we had this one-size-fits-all approach towards serving those customers and very little attention paid to the barriers to employment. We also had some pressure because during that time, the council also put some limits on the 60-month requirements and began a gradual reduction of their cash assistance over a five-year period. So these were all of the, you know, the changing needs sometime around 2008, between 2008 that caused us then to begin the reformatting and the redesign of our program. Next slide. So some of the key elements we had, you know, we decided that we would have a tiered service delivery model rather than the one-size-fits-all. We began using the online work readiness assessment that was developed by ICF International with the support of Maryland and many other states. And so we did an upfront assessment and then used the results of those assessments to develop a individual responsibility plan. We restructured our performance-based contracts to make them more flexible and allow us to build to scale. We also targeted some employment and barrier remediation service providers in order to ensure that we had good continuity of services, and when we made a referral, it was an intelligent referral. And then we really put some structure behind some cross-agency collaboration to leverage their expertise, particularly in the area of mental health, substance abuse, and child welfare. And then we also developed a very robust data-driven model that helped us to make some decisions around not only referrals for customers, but also our progress in the program. Next slide. You can skip that slide. So the this is just to go in briefly about the different tiers that we have in our program model. Next slide. So what we found is that customers, you know, often fall into four primary areas. There are some that have good work histories and buffer the economy. They'd be working right now, and based on their assessments, they generally fall within a job placement category. There are others that need barrier remediation, but also need some additional education or job training in order to make them ready and to compete in the work environment, and they generally fit within a work readiness program model. Others, however, have higher barriers to employment and also need some additional work supports, and so you know, they may need more intensive services, and as a result, we have that category. And then finally, those that really need barriers to employment and more financial, more long-term permanent financial supports, such as SSI. And this is just the, you know, while people do straddle the different quadrants within the model, the thought is that as we begin to remediate barriers to employment, they would move from the that quadrant into the work readiness and job placement model. Next slide. So one of the key things that we did was we modified our policies to be more flexible. We focused with the customer, we focused less on the federal hours of participation and focused more on what the customer needed and desired to develop their plan. If they were placed in a job placement service, then the expectation is that they would meet the core and non-core requirements under the federal TANF rules. However, if they were placed in a work readiness model, we just wanted them to meet their hours of participation, and they had, and there was less emphasis on the core and non-core. The plan was developed based on the client's needs and ensuring that those barriers that needed to be remediated were addressed while they were engaged in a work and education or training activity. And then finally, those that were in the barrier remediation model, we did not focus on the hours requirement. Rather, we focused on those activities that needed to be addressed to remediate the barriers. And then when they were ready, then they would migrate into the other facets of the program model to meet either their core and non-core, depending on how they were functioning, or to meet the just the hours requirement under the model. What we found is that with that flexibility, customers actually were able to rise to the challenge, and we still saw an increase in our work participation rates because of it. Next slide. This is just an example of the program logic, depending upon where a person scored in the assessment. Next slide. We also developed some scoring methodology based on their work history, and this is just an example of how we would calculate, based on the person's work history, what score we would provide. Next slide. Similarly, we had within the logic model, we had some scoring, and this was helped. This was created with the assistance of our state superintendent for education using the ECASAS assessment. And this is just an example of the scoring logic relating to the education attainment levels. Next slide. And then similarly, we use some predictive analytical tools in order to help us to identify the barriers to employment and also the severity of those barriers and what the recommended referral would be. And this is just an example of the scoring relating to that. Next slide. Similarly, as the client's going through the assessment, identify specific barriers, there's a program logic that provides a recommended action based on the section of the assessment tool and the outcome of the indicators. And this is just an example of how we utilize that information. Next slide. In our system that we developed, we created some PDF reports that summarize the results. Customers get a copy of this that allows, it's almost like a roadmap for them that they can use towards developing a more detailed plan. And this is just an example of that type of report. We thought that those things were critical for customers as well as for the agency in order to understand the data and also predict what our needs were in the future. Next slide. And you can skip that slide. So one of the big changes that we put in place is we do the upfront assessments. And initially, we assessed all of our existing customers, which were somewhere around a little over 17,600 at the time. And then beginning in April of 2013, we shifted to all new customers coming through the door that were applying for benefits. And now the assessment and orientation is a condition of their eligibility. We then use that information to help to develop a customized referral and an individual responsibility plan for the customers. Next slide. So, you know, we can't do this without having well-trained staff and well-trained providers. Next slide. So we changed our program model to tie the vendor's compensation to particular outcomes, and those outcomes relate to completing education and training goals, meeting the participation requirements, obtaining an unsubsidized work placement, getting a higher paid wage, and retaining the job within 6 months. Both the customer as well as the provider get different benchmark payments. Customers can get as much as, I think it was somewhere around $1,400 on an annual basis for completing, different objectives. Next slide. The other thing is we spent a lot of time building relationships with other agencies and ensuring that there was continuity in the services. And some of that was breaking down silos that were in place within our respective agencies, as well as changing a culture of, not sharing information and not sharing data, to a culture of understanding that we have shared customers and clients that we serve on a regular basis. And with that close cooperation, we all achieve our own, the results that we're all trying to achieve. Everybody's interests are being met with that shared cooperation. And that's been not only the biggest challenge, but the most rewarding, because we're starting to see some of the results of that now. Next slide. Lessons learned. Next slide. So just within a few short months, we've seen a tremendous spike, not only in the number of incentive payments. The incentive payments are tied to achieving particular outcomes and also tied to participation, and we're seeing some very promising results from that. Next slide. I think that any state that decides to undertake any redesign efforts, you need to know what the problems are before you begin to tackle and begin the system reforms. It is a lot of work. You've heard from Washington and from Hawaii about the length of time and the amount of resources that it takes to put something into place. We literally started from the ground up. When we started, we had 10 staff that worked only with customers that were waiting for their eligibility decision to be made, and then the rest were done by contracts. Now we have almost 90 staff, and we have much more infrastructure in place in order to support this effort moving forward. We are finally in a position where we honestly believe that we can serve everyone that receives a TANF benefit right now. The other thing is that what's very difficult is to manage expectations and to make sure that you set clear benchmarks that your funders and your legislature and your executive management understand, so that you can ensure that not only you're keeping the fire on yourselves in terms of making progress, but also so that everyone understands that this transformation doesn't happen overnight. And then lastly, make sure you understand what your capacity is. We have been very challenged with being able to move forward, not only because of our staffing resources that we've been able to, achieve over the last year, but also with health reform and building a new eligibility system. Many of our staff resources, particularly in the area of policies and program development, have been extremely strapped. Next slide. And then just be aware that you need to make sure that you have the ability to scale and develop a model that's internally consistent with your agency and your state policies. All right, next slide. All right, I'm done. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. At this time, we'd like to begin our question and answer session. On the screen, you'll see an example of how to submit a question through the online platform. We do have several questions already in the queue, so I'm going to go ahead and get started on those while others are being submitted. The first question is for Washington State, Babette. In regards to your assessment tool, is the tool appropriate for both two-parent families as well as single-parent families, and are you finding success with both?
It is for all families, so yes, both single-parent and two-parent families, but the assessment tool is for the entire caseload. We haven't rolled out statewide, so it's hard for me to say we're finding success with both. But in the user testing, I don't believe that we saw any difference in the comments around one-parent families versus two-parent families.
Thank you. For Hawaii, specifically Catherine, does the employer or your state staff provide the mentoring and job coaching for your participants of the See Hawaii program?
We have a private contractor that administers the See Hawaii Work program, and they actually provide three aspects. One is the employer relations specialist. They actually go out and market and recruit employers. And second is the job retention coaches. They do the mentoring. They do the follow-ups in terms of once a participant or a participant is referred, they do the intakes, the assessments, and the referrals to employers and follow-ups in terms of interviews and coaches them through the placement process. And lastly, our contractor also provides or issues the payments. So yes, we do provide, the contractor provides those services.
Thank you. For Washington, D.C., what process do you take in D.C. for follow-up for mental health referrals?
We have a partnership with our Department of Behavioral Health that will do a more in-depth assessment for any customer that screens for mental health or substance abuse. And we are literally about to award a contract to one or more providers to provide trauma-informed care to them so that any customer that doesn't have necessarily have a diagnosis but has experienced trauma will be able to receive services through that network as well. What this will allow is that they will not have to go through the typical screening process. That person will be able to get a direct referral to the service provider.
Great, thank you. Back to Washington State. Do you suggest contracting with your vendors to increase employment levels with your customers, which could also help in the on-the-job training? Babette, I'm not sure if you're on mute.
I'm on mute, sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm talking to myself. I think I would. We contract with our providers, and in our contract we do have performance expectations, and around those performance expectations, some of them are percentages that move to employment and then retain employment. So I do suggest that there are metrics around those when you're working with your with contractors, either at a state level or a local level. I'm hoping that answered the question.
Thank you. For Hawaii, why did you decide to leave the asset limits in place for the aged, blind, and disabled programs?
It's because our statutes directly
state that we are to apply the federal limits to our general assistance and aged, blind, and disabled population. So, and of course, that's 2,000 for a single and 3,000 for a couple. So, are those two programs are actually a safety net program here in Hawaii for the people that do not qualify for federal assistance. So basically many of our GAs and our ABD population, it's an interim assistance, and the idea is they will move on to federal benefits, especially our ABD population. Our general assistance population, many of them obviously have temporary disabilities, and but some of them we have them apply for federal benefits, and actually quite a few of them do qualify. So we decided not to mess with the federal asset limit requirements, because many of the RGAs and ABDs do move on to those programs. So we left it alone.
Thank you. For Washington, D.C., could you describe your staff training?
Sure. Brian, you want to take that one?
The staff training, we've been rolling people on. As Deborah said, we started with 10. Now we're up to pushing 70. The first trainings we did focused on essentially the assessment part of it, because that's what we were focusing on with assessments. And so we did strength-based interviewing. And actually, we're looking to get more outside help on that as we start pivoting to our workers having being case coordinators and having more of a case, carrying a caseload. We also have monthly meetings with all of our respective vendors to essentially keep them abreast of what are going on with the policy changes and things of that nature.
Great, thank you. For Washington State, what is the specific motivational interviewing program that you're using?
Oh, that's a great question. We are contracting with Washington State University, specifically with Casey, I believe his last name is Jackson, Casey Jackson, in the motivational interviewing that he, curriculum that he's developed.
Thank you. For Washington, D.C., you mentioned a trauma-specific training. Could you identify that a little bit more specifically?
Yeah, the trauma-informed care is a method of assisting customers that experience, whether it be sexual abuse or domestic violence or witness, a crime. It is based on a program that I believe comes out of the Midwest somewhere, and I'll have to get the specific information. And not only does our Department of Behavioral Health, but our Child and Family Services Agency trained all of their social workers in utilizing this method of assisting families and individuals that have experienced trauma. So the goal is to bring that to the TANF population, particularly those that have been on TANF for long periods that may have experienced trauma and have not had those issues addressed over the last, several years that they've been receiving the benefits. That's typically our approach. Hopefully we'll have someone in place within the next month or so we can see, how it's going to be implemented. It's also, this particular program is going to be coupled with AIDS and HIV testing and assistance for individuals or families that are also at risk of, of obtaining that disease, as well as substance abuse. And that's oftentimes because these families self-medicate and, might need some added assistance in those areas. So we'll hopefully be able to report on the outcome of that in the next few months.
Thanks so much. For the questions that have been submitted that have not yet been addressed, we will review those with the presenters, identify the appropriate answers, and provide those answers back to all the attendees on today's webinar. It is at the end of our time together, and I would like to say on behalf of the Administration for Children and Families, Region 10 Office, we would like to thank everyone for attending this webinar and for your thoughtful discussion. Thank you to our presenters for sharing their experience and knowledge of implementing their TANF redesign efforts. A transcript and audio recording will be made available for everyone in the coming weeks. And we're also excited to announce the save the date. The Region 10 office is planning a second webinar for Thursday, December 12th on 2 p.m. Eastern Time on strengthening TANF and low-income families through strategic non-custodial support. Details regarding registration will be available soon. We welcome your feedback. A survey will pop up on your computer screen in a separate window momentarily. Please be sure to provide your feedback on this survey so we can continue to improve our webinars. Once again, we'd like to thank all of you for